Hello and welcome to another episode of the Student Loan Planner Podcast with Travis. And today I want to talk about the top 10 worries people have about the future of their professions in 2025. We did a big survey of over 8,000 readers. That's the number of people that replied in the survey. And we asked a bunch of questions. And some of the questions we asked were a little bit more freeform in nature. That was one of the big questions that we asked. What are you worried about when it comes to your profession in 2025? Now, there was a lot of different answers. I thought that it would be kind of interesting just to kind of cover the top 10, because I think the top 10, not all of them apply to every profession, but most of them do. And so I thought I would go through each one and kind of explain my thoughts on each and think about the future state of things and where we are headed with loan limits coming into play in the fall of 2026 and why that influences things for everybody, especially existing practitioners in professions that have a lot of student loan debt, which is why, you know, a lot of people listen to this podcast. The top 10 list of the most big time worries people have got in their careers. Number one, student loans and debt to income ratio. I'm not surprised with this. I'm going to talk about the top three, and this is not necessarily in any given order. Student loans and debt to income ratio. Number two, insurance and reimbursement rate cuts. Number three, low pay versus cost of living. First, student loans and debt to income ratios. When they came out with Grad PLUS loans in 2006, it opened the floodgates of schools being able to charge whatever they want for higher ed. With that change, you saw the number of schools in most professions that didn't have any kind of constraints as to how many schools could open. You saw most school like professions just have a floodgate of schools open. So as an example, I like to give this example a lot because I memorized the data by this point, but there were about 43 pharmacy schools in about 2005 timeframe, 2005, 2006. And then only a few years later, there was something in the order of like 79, like literally a few years later. So to go from 43 schools where that number had been fairly steady for several years to 79 in a course of only 3 or 4 years, that is an example of the influence of Grad PLUS. And what happened is a lot of the schools that opened were opening and they were more expensive marginally to open because they were not already existing. There was a lot of startup costs, a lot you have to go out and hire new faculty, pay whatever the above market rate is to go attract that new faculty list, right? So you saw a lot of these newer schools that opened up that also offered a lot more admission spots to people that may or may not have gotten into some of these schools with the prior limited number of spots. A lot of these schools have much higher student loans in general, which caused the overall student loan debt to income ratio to go up in the profession. Now, what also happened at the same time over the course of several years is as all these new schools opened up and unleashed all of these new professionals into the market, the supply of labor increased and the demand maybe increased, but maybe not as much as the supply increased. And so we saw in some cases incomes stagnate or not go up all that much, or even in some cases sort of by adjusting for inflation, maybe decreasing. And so that's what caused a lot of the debt to income ratio numbers to go up. If we think about the future of student loans, with grad loans being capped at $20,500 and professional school loans being capped at $50,000 per year for all programs that people start borrowing for after July 2026, that's going to put a mathematical limit on the debt part of the debt-to-income ratio. With fewer new grads coming out every year, that is over time going to result in more limited supply, so that's going to push incomes up. So student loan debt-to-income ratio is likely over time going to improve if the current new laws stay in place, which I'm not saying are good laws. I'm just saying if they do, that's what I would predict is the student loan debt to income ratio will be less of a pain point. Number two is insurance and reimbursement rate cuts. So this is also tied to supply. This is tied to supply of labor in a big way. So why can Delta Dental pay $19.99 for cleaning? I'm joking a little bit, but like in some ways, people that are dentists will hear that and be like, yeah, that was too close to home. So why are insurance reimbursement rates declining? There's a lot of reasons. In reality, like when greedy companies want to do something, they can only do it if they're able to. So you might say, well, sometimes they're not able to because of laws and regulations. That's true. But I think what's mainly going on is what I see when I talk to like healthcare providers that have to deal with frustrating insurance reimbursement rates and stuff like that, a lot of the people that make the highest incomes that I talk with, especially like on the dental side, for example, are like out of the way spots. Maybe they take one PPO or something, but maybe they don't take any and they're just cash pay. And they can do that because there isn't a lot of other options around them. You know, I remember I talked to one person that was in like rural Minnesota once. It was like, okay, if you have a really bad toothache in the middle of the winter, your choices are drive an hour and a half in this through the snow, or show up to his office that's open and pay cash. Those are your two choices. Which one do you want to do? And so he made a really good living because he was offering something at a price that didn't have a lot of competition, and insurance ultimately had no leverage over him because he's the only option. He's the only provider. So when I see people frustrated that they, you know, they take every PPO under the sun, in some ways people feel like they have to, because if they don't accept all the PPOs, they're worried they're going to lose patients. They're worried, you know, that if they don't take certain insurances, that's going to hurt them as a business. In some ways too, you might be concerned about access, like the justice of providing services to people. Like that's a concern as well. But like viewed for the economic lens only for a moment, most people take every insurance under the sun because they feel like they have no other choice. And when people do that, the insurance companies think, huh, this is kind of cool. It seems like we have a situation where people are going to accept our reimbursements no matter what. And so let's see if we can not adjust those reimbursements with inflation. Let's see if we can even cut those reimbursement rates. Let's see if we can do all these really annoying things that make it much harder to get a claim approved because it saves us money. Ultimately, that only works if enough doctors are willing to say yes. Otherwise, you know, the insurance coverage wouldn't be providing any value to anybody that uses it. The limiting of the supply of new grads would also basically take away a lot of the leverage that some of the insurance companies have. But they'll still have some leverage, just to be clear. And where they're going to have more leverage are in areas where there's more saturation, where more people like and want to practice, and they'll have less leverage no matter what happens over that rural North Minnesota dentist that has no competition. So that's just an example of insurance reimbursement rates. Let's tackle low pay versus cost of living. This is also, I think, mostly a complaint that I see with people that live in urban areas. So if you live in an urban area like, you know, in LA, New York, North Jersey, South Beach, the most popular parts of the country to live in that also tend to also have some of the highest labor supply of providers that want to live in those locations, that does two things. It pushes down the salaries that you can make in those areas because you have an oversupply of people that want to work there and want to live there. And then the cost of living in those areas because of the wonderful amenities that those places offer, right? Like the wonderful weather of California, the beautiful beaches of Miami, the wonderful culture of New York City, people want to live there. And so the amenities for living there are worth a lot of money. And so therefore living costs are higher. Those areas could do different things to tackle living costs, right? Like some people think that the answer is more regulation, more rent controls, things like that. Other people think that the answer is more ability to build, permitting processes being reformed, things like that, right? So it just sort of depends on your politics, what you think the answer is for addressing that cost of living. But that pain point of low pay versus cost of living, that's very much a, you know, I am a person that is living in an urban area that has to face a lot of competition from other providers economically. So if you want to live in an urban area, I think a lot of times, in some ways, the answer can sometimes be more deeper specialization in your field. So as an example, if you are just a general practitioner in an urban area, you know, that's going to put you, you're going to have to deal with maximal competition as somebody who has a larger amount of supply of labor that could replace you. Whereas if you are, let's say, instead of a general practitioner, let's say you've got some sort of surgical subspecialty that not a lot of people do, or you have, you know, a residency that you went through to become an oral surgeon versus just a general dentist, right? Like if you want to live in a more urban area, in my experience, going for that extra specialty is actually very helpful. If you are more content working in an out-of-the-way place, in a place that is going to more greatly need and demand your services because the number of people that want to live there is much lower, then your ability to, well, first of all, your cost of living is going to be lower and your pay is going to be higher. So it's kind of like, it just sort of depends on what kind of life you want to live. And if you want to live a life in a big urban area, then you're probably better off going deeper into specialization. If you're okay living in more of an out-of-the-way place, then you know it, you can make a lot of money and have it go a lot farther if you just get started working and just start a practice or own a practice or do something along those lines. I'm never going to forget this one person that I talked to who was like a dentist in rural Iowa. She's like, the only thing here to do is watch Netflix. I mean, not to pick on rural Iowa. And she was producing $2 million of revenue and earning something like $250,000 a year. And it was because that was the only practice in town. It was owned by a corporate DSO. They couldn't get anybody to go work there. And so they just said, well, let's do a $250,000 salary. And that brought her there. And I was like, are you realize how much they're underpaying you? they're underpaying you because, you know, 30% of collections is what a lot of dentists will make, and 30% of $2 million is 600 grand, not 250. And she didn't have a non-compete. So I was like, goodness sakes alive. Threatened to open up shop across the street, or they give you a big raise, or you, you know, one of the two. Imagine what $600,000 a year buys you in rural Iowa. Oh my gosh. But then in that urban area, the huge amount of competition, the high amenities, people want to pay more to live there. That's what that struggle is. So the next top three on my top 10 list, I'm going to tackle AI and automation, burnout and workload, and then corporate takeover and consolidation. Number four, AI and automation. So I recently asked ChatGPT, you've got somebody with 200K of loans, 100K of income. They're married to somebody that makes this amount of income, this amount of loans. What should they do? And its response was basically sign up for the SAVE plan and file taxes jointly. That's what it basically said to do. Now, I don't know a ton about AI. A lot of you listening will know more about it than I do. But what I do know about it, from talking to some people that know more than I do, some of these GPT models essentially end at a certain date. So if anything new happens after the date that the GPT model went live or kind of scraped everything to figure out what to tell people, then those new developments don't get taken into the AI model and you could get outdated information. So in the fast moving field of student loans where things are constantly changing, that's a pretty big problem. So that's why it told me sign up for the SAVE plan, because it hadn't followed in anything since the GPT model ended that monitored, hey, wait, the SAVE plan no longer exists. Now there's other options. In terms of the tax consequence, it essentially did something called an AI hallucination, I think, is maybe that's not the technical term for it. But some people that know more about this than I do essentially say if AI can't find something or doesn't know something, it still has to give an answer. So rather than say, I don't know, what AI does is it hallucinates an answer. It makes up an answer if it can't find enough source material to make a decision. And so it kind of relies on users in some ways, I think, to learn for, you know, it's going to essentially give you information. And then a user, if enough users say, hey, no, that's wrong, that's incorrect, then the AI updates its model and it learns from people that way. It remembers, okay, X number of people said an elephant is not a pig. And then because 10,000 people said, hey, sorry, an elephant is not a pig, you know, then it doesn't tell people that the next time. I mean, that makes sense, right? So it's like it kind of relies in a big way on people using it to make it better. The other thing that's interesting about AI, and I'll just share this from a personal perspective as a publisher of a website with content on it, I was not ready for AI to come out and exist. I wasn't expecting it to come out and exist when it came onto the scene in a big way a few years ago. I had my website built and structured for a world of SEO traffic where you want to let Google crawl things and see your web articles because it's going to source all of your stuff and put it in Google search for people click on it, where people would read it, join your email list, etc. So that's the setup that I had. But then ChatGPT comes in without my permission or any publisher's permission, and then goes and scrapes all the content and then regurgitates it and doesn't send traffic to the publisher that wrote the analysis. And so we're seeing a lot of lawsuits, like New York Times is one of the companies suing ChatGPT, because effectively you have to pay to get a New York Times subscription, right? Well, ChatGPT just took all the information from the New York Times, taught its model, and it's now using it without paying New York Times anything. Well, that might be fine for the move fast and break things ethos of a tech company. And with its valuation being like hundreds of billions of dollars, that's such a high valuation that they can kind of get away with any kind of lawsuit or fine or penalty, really. That's what they're really thinking, is just transparently they can afford to go out and steal people's intellectual property because whatever fine or lawsuit that they get will be able to be paid for. That's, they're making a business decision. How have publishers like me, and I'm a micro publisher compared to the grand world of things, how am I reacting to AI? Well, transparently, I'm putting more of our content behind a private paywall where AI can't read it. In the past, I would write pretty much everything and give it away for free. But if something's like very valuable, very sensitive, very intense analysis that takes tons and tons of hours to write, and I think that there's a chance that AI is going to scrape it and regurgitate it to a lot of people without giving me any credit, some of that stuff, not all of it, right? Because we still have a free newsletter and I give away most of everything we do. Probably 90% plus we still give away for free. But I started the paid newsletter SLP Insiders to give away a small amount of it only to our paying customers behind the paywall where ChatGPT can't get access to it. SLP Wealth clients, same thing. Like, there's some strategies with SLP Wealth clients that are even more money saving than what I would share with insiders. And we only distribute that knowledge through our financial planners and through our SLP Wealth weekly client update on Fridays. So I'm reacting as a content creator to protect my intellectual property and my skills from AI. It's kind of like you get punched in the face without expecting it, like walking down the street. And the next time you walk down the street and you know you might get punched in the face, you protect yourself a little bit. You raise your hands, you block your face from the clear path to getting punched, right? That's what's going on right now, I think, with AI, and AI is going to have some trouble adapting to that, I think. The more reality way to think about this with AI, like why is what's going on in my business relevant to you? I guess what I'm saying is technology comes out, everybody's like, oh my gosh, this is going to be everything. This is going to be, you know, this is the cat's meow. This is going to change the way the world works. This is going to totally upend absolutely everything. And what it does is it just sort of, in some ways it does, but in other ways, like it's something that people don't have to worry about as much as they worry about. So like, think about the internet, life-changing technology, right? You're listening to this because of the internet. Smartphones, same thing. You're listening to this because of smartphones. You would not be listening to this on your work computer probably in the absence of smartphones. You just wouldn't do it. It's not convenient enough. So there is life-changing technology, but what's going to happen over time is AI is going to maybe try to monetize, try to accept paid ads, same way that Google makes most of its money through paid search, you know, people bidding on keywords. AI might start surfacing paid sponsored keywords, especially on its free plan, right? And it might raise the paid plan from $20 to $100 a year. And then you do that or you make it free for the other people. And right now, everybody's so excited about it that the valuations are sky high. And so they can afford to really do anything. Nobody's worried about revenue because the technology is so exciting. But eventually, that model cools off, right? And Netflix starts charging you for ads or whatever. Or Amazon Prime starts charging you for ads, or they make you pay for the other model. So anyways, how is this again relevant to professionals that are worried about AI? You have lobbying groups that fight for your interest. You might say, I don't trust the American Dental Association. I don't trust the AVMA or whatever. I don't trust the American Bar Association. Well, hold up. You know, a lot of rules exist the way that they do, both at the state level and the federal level, because of the power of special interest lobbying groups. I'm not saying that as a pejorative. I'm saying that as I don't know. I remember one summer I worked for the late Senator Bob Graham, good man. You know, he told me an interesting story where it's like the state of Florida chiropractors kind of lobby assigned a chiropractor to like every state legislator or something like that to like give them concierge treatment as patients or something like that. I'm probably, with apologies to Senator Graham, I'm forgetting the exact story, but essentially it was a very strategic way to get FaceTime from chiropractors to state legislators to get hopefully influence over the state regulations. And he wasn't involved with this. This was just like an observation that he saw when he was a state legislator in the 70s or something. But it was like they had a strategy to get preferred regulations and legislation done in a way that would allow them to practice a certain way with certain kinds of economic protections. Like we saw with Hollywood writers making a deal with studios that they can't use AI in certain ways, I think that we're going to see essentially lobbying from very important professions. Like, you know, physicians are a very powerful political lobby, very, very powerful. When AI does start threatening people's jobs, there's going to be strong pushback from these professions to protect their interests. Like if lawyers start getting worried that AI is taking away from billable hours, I guarantee you lawyers are going to work hard to protect their interests to limit certain amounts of AI use or to limit the amount of AI that you can use in legal cases or something along those lines. I mean, there's all kinds of things that you could think about, right? And ways that AI could be limited in scope. And what's most likely, I think, is that AI is going to be used by professionals to make them more efficient. So that, if anything, that I think that will help over time the most skilled professionals be even more impactful in terms of the value that they're able to bring to the table. It's going to, I think, over time make productivity gains in the economy happen, which the question is will employers capture those? Will the professionals capture those? That depends on leverage you have in your position, which is supply-demand, I think. Anyways, that's my pitch on or thoughts on the AI worry that people have, is that it's overblown and people don't even be quite as worried as people are currently worried. I will say I remember looking at lawyers on our email list. I think that was the number one by far worry that lawyers had. A lot of the other more, you know, physical professions, right, didn't have nearly the level of worry about AI that lawyers did. But even if people are super worried about it, I think that they should be a little less worried about it. Number five, burnout and workload. This makes sense. I see the impact that high amount of clinical work has on families. I'm married to a surgeon. I understand how people can get really tired in their professions. And I understand, too, the sort of compassion fatigue that a lot of providers have, right? Like, I remember a veterinarian telling me, like, a tough story of how her practice was in, like, rural Alabama, and the vast majority of her customers could not afford to pay for elective treatment. And they would bring in a dog with a broken leg, and the veterinarian would tell her that she could save the dog for $500, and they didn't have that to spare. And so she would have to spend, you know, whatever the low cost is to euthanize the dog instead of fix the dog's leg, and that ate her up inside. And I think that that makes sense. There's some things that are related to the strain that these jobs take just in general, and then there's other things I think that happen because, again, I think a lot of this is a little bit leverage related. Like, if you have an oversupply of new grads, employers can kind of push you around more, right? Employers can force you to do more things that you don't want to do. And because there's so many new grads, because there's such an oversupply, they can get away with it. So I'm thinking that the burnout, the workload that folks have, I think that that will go down in terms of pain points as there's more limited supply, but that's just a guess. Burnout is always going to be a problem with medical professionals and people with very challenging, very taxing jobs like you have. Number six on the top 10 worries list, corporate takeover and consolidation. It's not shocking news to people in your profession. You know this already, but you know, there are so many private equity-backed takeovers of healthcare groups. There's so many private dental service organizations and, you know, corporate private equity-backed activity in the dental space. There's so much private equity activity and big, big money activity in the veterinary space, right? Like, the people that own M&Ms own a huge portion of the veterinary practices in America. There's all this consolidation. There's way tighter competition for new practices that come on the market, and these private equity groups pay way more in some cases than, you know, a new grad could be able to even get loans for. So what's going on with the corporate takeover? What's going to happen with that? The big thought that I have on that is it's driven by the massive numbers of new grads that are out there. So if you have a lot of new grads coming out with big debt-to-income ratios, they're terrified, they're looking for a guaranteed salary, private equity is like, here, come over here, we can help. I think that when you have a lot fewer new grads coming out in the field, I think that you're going to see a lot harder time for corporations to be able to offer anything that's attractive enough where people would want to take it as much as they used to. Same thing for consolidations. I think that that's reliant on a guaranteed supply of labor. You want to have that guaranteed supply of labor before you go plop down, you know, a huge multiple on a practice, knowing that you're, you know, wanting to have a certain target rate of return. You need to know that your labor costs are going to be low enough to be able to get that target return. So I think that capping student loans is bad news for corporate takeovers and consolidations. Number seven, eight and nine. I'm going to go through these a little bit quicker. Number seven, job security and layoffs. So again, lower supply of folks out there, fewer layoffs, more job security. I don't think I need to go too much more into that. Number eight, policy and political uncertainty. This is one that's not related to the student loan stuff really at all, right? If you are worried about random advice coming out of left field at the Department of Health and you're like, oh gosh, what do I tell people now? I can't help with that. If you are wondering about what's going to happen with NIH funding or something like that, I don't have anything for you there. That's a worry that's going to stay, I think, high on the list for people, especially people who don't agree politically with the current administration. You've got 3 more years at a minimum. That's going to continue to be a pain point for folks that have that political belief or that view of the current administration. Number nine, market oversaturation. Market oversaturation, again, is a direct result of a couple things. One is there's a natural oversupply that happens when people want to live in a desirable area. So again, everybody wants to live in LA, everybody wants to live in New York or South Beach. People want to live there. It's an exciting place to live as a young professional with money, with intelligence, with education, with skills. People just gravitate to those places. So there's some natural oversupply. And then for the other part of it that's not the natural supply oversupply, it's the massive amount of loans and the unlimited nature of loans that allow way more schools to exist than would if you had any kind of like underwriting with private lenders or if people were had to pay out of pocket. So I do think that that's going to correct itself quite a bit with the changing in the loan limits. Number 10, though, is a tough one. Accessibility and then value of people's professions. Ultimately, people valuing a profession is a challenge for everybody, right? In an era where people can put in information into their phone and get answers to things, the problem is a lot of people don't even realize that a lot of the answers that AI and ChatGPT give are completely wrong. They just like that it's free. And when something's free, a lot of times people will gladly do something that's stupid because it's free instead of paying for advice. I face it all the time, right? And a lot of people realize after they mess things up a bunch, oh shoot, maybe I should have gotten some paid help for XYZ problem that I have. It's pretty common, and I think it's going to become more common, that people are going to have a harder time with people perceiving value in their profession because people are going to say, oh, well, I don't need legal advice. I can just ChatGPT. Do I need to, you know, do a whatever? Do I need to, you know, hire a lawyer for this thing? Or, you know, can you tell me this legal advice on starting my LLC or whatever it is, right? But I think what's going to happen is people are going to, in some ways, it's kind of like people who chug Mountain Dew. Like people who do a lot of it, you know, it always comes back to haunt you, right? Like you're going to the dentist, you're going to have even more work done because you decided to chug Mountain Dew all day, every day, instead of, you know, going to routine cleanings and maybe moderating a little bit. So I think that the AI stuff is going to actually cause, in some ways, sometimes some people's professional work, they're going to get more work because people are going to make so many mistakes. They're going to realize, oh shoot, I should have paid a lot more money for something that would have really helped me. And then the accessibility thing is going to continue to be a challenge. Accessibility, I mean, both for patients and people trying to get your services, as the supply goes down, people are going to have to pay more money to work with you. That's the other reality. If you have lower supply of professionals, the market price for services goes up. So that's going to be a challenge for accessibility for the public to access your services. There's also going to be a big problem on having equal access for people in all socioeconomic groups for different professional degree programs. So if you want to go become a lawyer or a medical doctor or, you know, a dentist, if you don't come from a rich family and you're not able to qualify for private student loans and the private lenders are not offering no cosign products, you're out of luck, right? You might not be able to achieve your dream of going to your preferred professional school unless you happen to join the military and unless the military happens to need that field, right? I mean, that might be the only option that some people can become a dentist in the future. And that's really unfortunate. There's a lot of negative things that will happen in terms of, you know, less diverse fields, less diverse professionals, professionals that are coming from wealthier families on average. Those are all negative things. I did share some, you know, positive things for existing providers, like less leverage from insurance companies, you know, with the reimbursement rates, the student loan debt to income ratio improve, the corporate takeover of a lot of healthcare fields would have less teeth. There would be more job security, fewer layoffs. So like with any policy change, there are some things that people would probably be like, I don't mind that happening. And there's a lot of things that are happening that people will be like, I wish that was not happening. Ultimately, what you can control is what you do. The value of getting good advice is as high as ever. I've got a bias in believing that, but I also have the YouTube me versus ChatGPT receipts to prove it. So if you need a student loan plan, go to studentloanplanner.com/book, get a plan from one of our experts. And of course, if you need more deeper help than that and you want to go deeper in trying to achieve your hopes and your dreams for the future, and not just student loans, but in everything, then you could look at our financial planning firm, slpwealth.com. Thank you so much for listening to the Student Loan Planner podcast. I promise I'll get to a voicemail episode soon. So if you want to leave a voicemail question, studentloanplanner.com/voicemail. Thank you for listening to our show. I've been doing this for years because you listen. And thank you so much for being a listener. Have a wonderful rest of your week. Are you on the free Student Loan Planner email list? If yes, you can upgrade your experience and discover student loan loopholes so good, they might get repealed if I talk about them publicly. Find out my very best thought leadership that I really just can't be super open about anymore, unfortunately. If you want to get our very best tips, not just the ones that I can share for free, go to studentloanplanner.com/insider to get a special discount for your year membership. That's studentloanplanner.com/insider and get our very best dozens of bonus content and tips that's going to save you money and get you out of student debt faster. And if you're already an SLP insider, please reply back to those emails and let me know how I can make it even more valuable.